CMC Markets is a pioneering CFD and spread betting provider. With more than 30 years of experience, CMC Markets provides traders with the tools they need to trade confidently. 76% of retail investor accounts lose money.
Hello and welcome to the CityView podcast in partnership with CMC Markets. I'm Andy Sylvester from City AM, and in a few minutes I'll be joined by Tim Ashley, the man in the know when it comes to whiskey investment and all things single malt and alternative assets. But first, I'm joined by former B business journalist Susanna Streeter, now senior investment and markets analyst at Hargreaves Lansdown, to look at two stories that deserve a proper dig into. Susanna, thanks so much for joining.
You're welcome. Great to be here.
Now, we usually look ahead, but I think we're obliged to look back today instead at two brilliant business stories as journo and former journo, certainly lots to talk about. We'll start with Deliveroo, the much ballyhooed IPO on Wednesday of last week. I think it's fair to say that it didn't immediately go to plan for the firm.
It certainly didn't. I mean, it was heralded as the debut of the decade, really, wasn't it? And it left investors completely cold. There was such a lukewarm response. Even initially, when first of all, it set the target range for the IPO, there were lots of eyebrows raised at that 8.8 billion valuation at the upper end. And certainly it seemed as though institutional investors were also coming through saying, look, we're interested, but at the lower end. So almost straight away, you could see interest starting to fade away to this huge valuation that the company had tried to put on itself through, of course, the help of investment banks. And then, of course, we saw the launch and the share price plummeting at 30% from the IPO price. Very disappointing for the company. Of course, we know that timing is everything. And the timing, it just didn't get this right. I mean, you look at DoorDash in the United States, when that launched, there was kind of a sustained rise in the share price. It has fallen off, though, since the 10th of February, as we've seen with other tech stocks, really popular tech stocks as well. So certainly the timing was not right with Deliveroo, and it came at the same time, or just a few days really, after there was a big investigation by a number of journalistic organisations into its gig economy model. So all in all, it was a disastrous timing for this IPO.
Yeah, I thought what was most interesting to me was you saw this almost a clash of the old city and the new city and what investors are looking for, because you had an awful lot of investors, maybe slightly older school models of how they like to invest their cash and indeed their clients' cash, looking at the dual class element of it, looking at the fact that as an investor, you wouldn't have particularly much say necessarily in how the company was run going forward because of the way the shares were being offered and the fact that the founder, Will Shu, kept so much control. Then you had another part of the city, institutional investors who are now focusing on ESG concerns, also worried about the gig economy. And you got this sort of perfect storm, and then you combine that with a company that still hasn't necessarily shown it can make, huge amounts of cash outside of places where it already is operating, specifically London. You just get this perfect storm, and that's what happens when you float. That's what happens when you do, as Deliveroo did, when they put so much into hyping this and talking about it being debut of the decade, getting the Chancellor on board, welcoming the float. You're going to then get the scrutiny.
Well, ultimately, it was mispriced. Interestingly, where its shares fell to on the opening day, valuing the company at around 5.8 billion. Now, that was more of the valuation that was put on the company back in January when it had another round of investment. So certainly, if the price had been better priced, I don't think we would have seen this sinking disappointment, because obviously there is always a risk, with, for example, new tech offerings, even Facebook or Uber, lots of different companies that actually have seen their share prices rise significantly since the IPO have had very volatile starts. But I think, you know, the dramatic slide in just one day really wasn't what the company wanted at all. And as you say, there are a number of different kind of conflicting risks that some institutional investors were looking at. Those funds that said, look, we're just not interested. Some of them, yeah, as you say, it was to do with ESG, concerns over workers' rights, particularly among those with pension funds invested, for example. But, you know, it's all also to do with the fact that because there is this question mark over the gig economy going forward, that then dents into profitability if they do have to change the model. So there's an eye on that rather than just workers' rights. And yes, you, as you say, the dual class structure. But of course, under the Hill recommendations, that dual class structure listing would be allowed as a premier listing. And actually, there was a sunset clause of 3 years. There is, in terms of the dual class structure for deliveries. So it very much was kind of planned in the Hill review recommendations with those in mind, with a view to having a premier listing down the line if those recommendations are brought in. But yes, I do think that it was institutional investors who don't support those recommendations coming in thinking, you know, this is a chance for us to show why we don't like it.
Extraordinary, extraordinary story and all good fun. Now, from one company where people have been, you know, discussing what the future might hold and what the company does and so on and so forth in Deliveroo, to a firm that I think, you know, as business journalists, we just get used to writing, they've somehow done it again, and that's Next. Despite everything of 2020, and yes, revenues fell, etc., etc., profit guidance up for 2021, still profitable in 2020. You know, it's another one for Simon Wolfson's trophy cabinet.
Yeah, the great survivor again. So, yeah, profits may have halved to 42 million, but to be reporting any sort of profit at all as a high street fashion retailer after a year like 2020 is pretty remarkable. But in many ways, Next is a remarkable business. And of course, it had already spotted the potential for online retailing years before their rivals took it seriously. You know, because the very fact started off with the Next directory, distance selling. And it's really at the heart of the business. It has always been at the heart of the business. So it was already really geared up for this accelerated shift to online that we've seen. And so Next was already earning most of its money online even before the pandemic struck. So it has put it in a much stronger position than rivals like M&S or Arcadia and Debenhams, which collapses, as we well know. What was also quite interesting as well is that people are returning fewer items during the pandemic that helped Next put it in an even stronger position. But there, you know, there is still a warning ahead for the high street. You know, the group is still saying that high street future is uncertain, but interestingly, sales at retail parks held up particularly well, and that certainly seems to be where a lot of the kind of in-store shopping is shifting.
And now we turn to this week's special guest, Tim Ashley, one of three directors of VCL Vintners, an asset manager with a difference. VCL source and manage fine single malt Scotch whiskey.
Susanna, thanks so much for joining us.
The highest performing alternative asset of the 21st century, according to one bit of research. VCL currently holds about 70 million worth of whiskey under management and is on track to corner 2% of the whiskey industry's total reserved. It's a genuinely fascinating business. And Tim, great to have you on this morning.
Great to be here, Andrew. Thank you for having me.
Why don't we kick off with telling us how the business came about? Because it's the sort of thing you have to take, I imagine, in 2010 when you founded it, a bit of a leap of faith.
Yeah, I mean, the business started out primarily as an alcohol-related investment house, if you will, sourcing commodity products within that arena, which focused primarily on fine wine. You were coming off the back of a monumental period of growth in the fine wine market from 2007 right the way up to 2012, and you saw something in the region of about 250% growth across the board. The problem was the Chinese got heavily involved in the market at that point and really drove prices, and you know, you saw a massive bull run in the market, but it began to plateau after that point. And we were still keen to remain within the commodity arena. We've also always been fascinated with the whiskey market and you know, I like whiskey myself. But of course, we were looking into the whiskey market. We could see the growing trends. We could see that whiskey was increasingly stealing market share from the likes of wine and beer in the supermarkets. And when we looked with greater detail into the actual market dynamics, it became apparent that huge amounts of money were being generated from casks prior to their being filtered out the cask market into the bottle market. And it was something that was quite esoteric, quite secretive at that point. It was difficult to access. And so we moved largely into whiskey investment. We could have moved into whiskey investment via the bottle. It's a very established marketplace. However, we were keen to expose clients to greater profits by way of economies of scale, the maturation process that comes into play with a whiskey cask, the fact that it continues to age, and just the fact that there wasn't a great deal of accessibility for this particular product globally. So that was the kind of genesis of our journey into whiskey cask investment. And we collected at that point, I mean, I'm going back 7-8 years ago, some of the what are now the rarest and most hard to come by casks, you know, in the way of sort of 30-35-year-old Macallans. And we started assembling a very prestigious selection of casks, which we now hold today, and which have, you know, on some occasions, sort of 200-300% X, or 2-3 X rather. Yeah,
it's a genuinely incredible business, and what an opportunity to spot, as you say, in 2010 when things were very different. What do you think has made whiskey such a high performing asset, so to speak, as well as being very nice.
Yeah. Well, the very nice comes into play. The fact is, whiskey's always had appeal. But you're talking about a product that comes from a single small country. It's the lifeblood of Scotland. And historically speaking, it was produced for a domestic population of far fewer people and fewer still that can afford to drink it. But today, you've got widespread distribution networks globally. You know, the addressable market for generic whiskey today stands at 500 million consumers all across the world. If you look at the actual production levels of Scotch single malt in Scotland, maximum capacity, I'd say that they're capable of producing about 35 million litres of single malt annually. So you've got 35 million litres of single malt in production over the course of the year to satisfy potentially 500 million consumers of whiskey all around the world. And it really does come down to the fact that, you know, you've had boom and bust periods in whiskey. You've had the 1890s, you've had the 1980s, but you didn't have the same kind of marketing. You didn't have the global appeal, the global reach, the distribution networks that you have today. And we're just trying to build upon that, capitalize upon that, and, you know, expand that accessibility.
And thinking about that global market in particular, I mean, anybody who goes to, remember airports, Tim? We used to be able to go to them. You walk through duty free, yeah. And it's quite obvious that the market for whiskey has changed dramatically in the last sort of 5-10 years in terms of consumers as well as anything, yeah. Geographical spread and so on and so forth. Has that impacted your side of the business as well? The kind of the growth in the sort of the huge growth in the Asian market, but also those sort of specialized special release whiskey and special release expressions that seem to be all the rage in certainly airports.
Yeah, I mean, it can be the case. That in particular doesn't really have so much of a direct impact on our business because our model puts us behind those special releases in that we're trading the actual cask those special releases will be produced from. Yeah. I think what you did touch upon, though, which is important, is the fact that our particular business has been directly affected and improved by the global appeal of whiskey. There are many companies out there involved in the whiskey market, and some have extraordinary knowledge of whiskey and, dare I say, far more educated palates than I. But we take a different approach. We do really go into great depth, great detail to assess where in the world you've got perfectly inverse supply-demand imbalances for a particular distillery stock. You know, where in the world we've got 225 different whiskey consuming microeconomies globally that Scotch whiskey is distributed to, where which of those economies are consuming which volumes of that particular distillery, you know, what kind of money is being spent on PR, marketing, tourism for that particular distillery, how is that going to improve the brand's appeal and therefore the global demand for that product. So all of those points do come into play, and it's very, very, very much affected by these newer economies that are coming through and really, really playing a major and key part in whiskey consumption. If you look at the likes of India, which now consumes perhaps the highest volume of whiskey per capita in the world, Taiwan being another example. Go back to, say, the 1890s, I think perhaps a great many people who did consume whiskey in Scotland didn't even know where Taiwan was. These are key facts and key pieces of data that we as a company really do focus on.
And certainly, we talked about that, and you talked about I completely see where you're coming from. You talked about the market and how you tried to come in and do something slightly different. The sort of booze investment market has for a long time, I think that the sort of archetype of it is probably Fulham and probably lots of long holidays in France. And you, I think, are trying to do something slightly different and democratise it a bit.
Absolutely. Digitalise, perhaps. Democratise. Just create an industry. I mean, it's an enormous industry. It's Scotland's number one export. Accounts for 25% of all of the UK's food and drink export, approaching 1.5% of our total export. Forget oil. I mean, Scotland, whiskey for Scotland is their primary export and their primary produce. If it wasn't for whiskey, many of the rural communities in Scotland, would be hit financially, in direct association, warehousing, etc. So for us, there's huge amounts of money being generated by whiskey production, whiskey collection, whiskey investment, and it's historically been in the hands of a select few. So we are really focused on, in many ways, developing our presence in the industry, cornering a larger volume of the liquid available in the market, but making that larger volume more accessible. It hasn't been easy. It hasn't been an easy journey for us, Andrew. It's taken 10 years of, not only knocking on the doors, kicking them down, really, to get through. And I'm happy to say, we have direct access to all of the stock we want today. And we're just making it available through a fair, open, honest, and our intention is for a completely transparent fashion. We've just signed an exclusivity arrangement, the first of its kind in the history of Scottish single malt, with a distillery, wherein clients can go and see something akin to a spot price. They go to the distillery, they see the price of the stock, they see the price of all of the different releases produced by that distillery, the different cask expressions. And at that point, they can cross-compare the prices with ours. It's not something that's been done before, and it's definitely the direction we intend to go in.
Mm. Well, transparency is at the heart of every well-functioning market. Tim, it's been an absolute pleasure to have a quick whiz through the whiskey investment market. I've got one question to ask you. If you were, if you were investing right now, Scotch whiskey, what are you thinking? Where are you going with your money?
Specifically a distillery?
Oh, let's go regional before we get too into the weeds.
Oh, I think that you'd probably be safest in somewhere like Isla. Some people would lean towards things like Japanese whiskey, which we do have access to. But for me, it's grown at such an exponential rate over the past couple of years. It's a little dicey, I would say. So if you're sticking to Scotch single, first of all, stick to Scotland. It's got an unparalleled heritage, history, pedigree, provenance, the kind of which you'll find nowhere else. And within there, I think high-end, Speyside and Macallan. But if you're looking for a region which is populated by really high-end distilleries for investment purposes, I'd probably towards Islay.
And on that, we shall leave it. Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Have a great day.
And that's all from us at the City View podcast in partnership with CMC Markets. See you next week.